And up first, social scientists have been taking advantage of mobile phones and social networking sites to unobtrusively capture vast amounts of information in order to analyse our behaviour. And to discuss how such tactics are deployed is Dr. Jason Renfrow from the University of Cambridge. Hello, Jason.
Hi, Chris.
So first of all, kick off and tell us, well, how have social scientists collected data in the past and what are the problems with using those techniques?
Well, most research in psychology collects data in laboratory settings. So at just about any psychology department at any university, you will have space designated for psychologists to recruit university students and then to subject these students to all sorts of interesting, oftentimes mundane tasks. And essentially what ends up happening is that these university students will complete a variety of different questionnaires. They may be presented with various stimuli and asked to respond to these stimuli. They may be looking at reaction time, how quickly people hit space bars, and occasionally there may be hidden cameras present in these rooms, and the researchers will then watch the videos of these participants' behavior and code them on various indices.
This is not, however, a natural environment for those individuals, so there's a real danger
that
they are going to tell you what you want to hear, or you're basically changing the outcome by the way you're measuring the data.
Well, yeah, that's exactly right. In theory, psychology, and in particular social psychology, the area that I work, is interested in understanding how people behave in the natural environment. And a lot of psychologists will go to great lengths to create a seemingly natural ambiance or atmosphere within these laboratory settings to simulate these real-world experiences. Of course, the big advantage of working in a laboratory is that you have a lot of control over extraneous variables, and that's one of the main reasons why researchers will do their work in labs as opposed to the real world.
Given the constraints, then, what are you trying to do to get around those problems?
Well, essentially, we're trying to use new technologies to understand how people behave in their everyday lives. I was approached a few years ago to begin collaborating with some computer scientists, Cecilia Mascolo, who's at the computer laboratory at Cambridge. And together with other colleagues, we've started using the sensors in smartphones, and really any of the typical smartphones that are on the market now are capable of measuring a wide variety of different sorts of behaviors. So, for example, smartphones have accelerometers, light sensors, obviously have microphones, GPS, and by extracting data from these different sensors, we have the potential to observe people behave in the natural environment.
Because they're more comfortable using the phone, because they're well acquainted with using it, it's not an artificial situation for them. It is incorporated into their everyday lives. It doesn't change their behaviour, its involvement, and therefore you get a more accurate representation of what's real for that person.
That's absolutely correct. I mean, I don't know the most recent statistics, but millions of people have carry around a smartphone with them every day. And by writing applications that will essentially extract information from these sensors, and then by doing more controlled research, we can begin looking at how profiles of behavioral profiles as measured by these sensors may represent certain dispositions, or people are in certain locations engaged in certain tasks, which can be extremely informative from a social scientific perspective.
So what sorts of problems are you going to be focusing on? What can you use this to address?
Currently, the work that we've been doing has looked at emotional expression, and essentially what we've done is designed an application whereby participants will carry around their phone that's running this application called Emotion Sense, and the phone will register when the user is speaking, and there's a predefined set of emotion categories in this application, and essentially the user's speech is analyzed in real time, and it looks at certain speech parameters and compares them to this predefined dictionary, and essentially it will make inferences about the likelihood that the person may be experiencing happiness, sadness, fear, anger, or be in a neutral state. And so this is one way in which we can look at emotional expression and experiences in the real world, and then pair that information with location-based information information, as well as whether or not the user is in a social interaction and perhaps with whom they're interacting.
That's passive acquisition of information. What about flipping the coin over and going so that the phone then does something back to the person? Is that something that could be done in the same sort of way?
Yes, that's another direction that we're going. In collaboration with some psychologists and computer scientists at Southampton, we've recently secured a funding to essentially conduct, to design behavioral interventions that we can deliver using these mobile phones. Behavioral interventions getting at, for example, smoking cessation or weight management.
So you could take, say, the behaviours that you know tend to be displayed by someone who might be about to relapse and have a cigarette when they're trying to quit, because you know what those sorts of behaviours based on their profile would be, and then you could trigger the phone to engage some kind of helping strategy or distraction or phone a friend to dissuade you from lighting up.
That's exactly right. I mean, there have been studies that have used text messaging to help people quit smoking. And in these types of studies, essentially users or participants will explain and provide information about their reasons for wanting to quit, their motives, and they will provide information about the triggers that make it difficult for them to quit. By providing text messages without any other information, you may be sending messages whenever they're not really needed. But using the sensors in these phones, if we might learn from the participants that on Friday nights, whenever they go to a particular pub or when they're with a certain group of individuals, their urge to smoke is strongest. So we can essentially program this information into the user's phone and then trigger messages to them whenever they're in these vulnerable situations.
There is still a slight snag with this, that being that it relies on the fact that it assumes that everyone's got a smartphone. And there are many people, actually I don't own one, there's a confession. So there are many people who wouldn't have one and they would lie outside the scope of your acquisition of your data. Do you think this is a problem that will be solved by just time anyway?
I suspect so. I think adoption rates are quite high for these smartphones. And you're absolutely right that there are constraints. However, even the less smartphones have capabilities that would still allow for delivering such interventions. They just may not have all the full functionality as on the smartphones.
But what I'm getting at is that a lot of the behavioral monitoring you're talking about doing, is there not a risk that the kind of person who will have a phone and the kind of person who will sign up to let you eavesdrop on their behaviour may not be representative of the population at large? So you've still got a problem.
Yes. That's absolutely right. I mean, we're not everyone, as you said, has a smartphone, and not everyone would be comfortable using such technology, even if they did have a smartphone. That certainly will be a limitation. In the research that we're doing, we are using other methodologies. Some of our collaborators have been very successful at delivering these interventions online. So for desktop computers or laptops, for example. And we'll be doing other studies in more controlled settings to essentially not only see whether or not there are user differences depending on which form of the intervention they choose, but also whether certain interventions may be more effective than others.
All right, well, we must leave it there. Thank you very much, Jason. Jason Renfrow from the University of Cambridge. Kat.